For 11 months of the year, Kiki happily does a Disney podcast with her good friend Tuesday. But for 1 month...
Ho, 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 no.
It's a holiday extravaganza! Happy holidays, Kiki!
Bah, humbug.
I'm trying, folks. Trying to get my friend into the holiday spirit. I know it's 2020. It's been a hell of a year. But it's almost over. At least be happy for that, you know?
I'm waiting to see what's on the other side. I'm scared.
2021 is rearing its head, and, well, the first half might still be the same. This might be 2020 extended. But let's try to forget it. That's kind of the whole point of this podcast, to remember the classic Disney movies that of old. But we do have to talk about one news story from the past week. Kiki, do you want to go through that?
Yeah, it is the unfortunate news that Dave Prowse, best known for being inside the Darth Vader suit in the original Star Wars films, at least, has died at age 85.
Long life.
Yeah.
It's sad that he's such a good actor, but he'll always be known for not showing his face.
Yeah, he was in other films. He shows up a little for a short moment in Clockwork Orange and things like that. And he did show his face and actually eventually get to do his voice in a series of PSAs that were very famous in the UK. Where he did the Green Cross Code Man, which was a character that would teach children about how to safely cross intersections and things like that. And so he was a bit of a known figure for children of that particular era in Britain, in the UK. But he is not really known for showing his face over here. Yeah, we kind of really only know him from Star Wars and maybe, you know, a couple of short, you know, cameos in this or that. But it was really, he was a really fascinating guy. I got to meet him once or twice. Attended a birthday party of his, weirdly. But yeah, he was a very kind of sweet, soft-spoken man. Started out as a bodybuilder, and that's why he was cast in the suit. He had a very large, imposing frame that really filled out that suit and towered over all the other actors. We talked in our Star Wars episode about how he honestly thought that his vocal performance was going to be the one in the film, and was not told that he was going to be dubbed over by James Earl Jones, and only found out at the premiere.
Yeah, and there's clips, if you can look of them, of the raw audio on set of David Prowse's Vader voice. Very angry, very intimidating, but it just doesn't have the bass, I guess, Lucas was looking for.
Yeah, it's a different take on Vader, of course, but it's not a bad portrayal, necessarily.
It sounds just like the other Imperial officers.
It's more Bond villain.
Yeah, yeah.
Because he's got that kind of higher, but not high pitched. I mean, he had a manly voice, but it was a higher register than James Earl Jones, of course, because everyone is. But it was kind of very like, you know, and now, Princess Leia, you will tell me the plan. You know, it was a very kind of Bond villain delivery.
Do you expect me to talk, Vader? No, I expect you to die!
Yeah, it was kind of more that. So, It would have been a different take, and while I do kind of support the dubbing over of the James Earl Jones voice because of what it became, I wish that George Lucas and the other producers had been more forthcoming with him. I think it was a kind of a pain he carried with him for a while.
At least until
the fans really knew who he was. Mm. I think by the end of his life, he had been so beloved and accepted at conventions and things like that, that people knew who he was, wanted their picture taken with it. So I think that kind of eased some of that. I'm sorry he had to wait so long for it.
Yeah. I'm forgetting his name, but the guy in the Chewbacca costume.
Peter Mayhew.
Peter Mayhew, thank you. I had a brain fart. Same one hit with him and Kenny Baker, you know, years later, all of these, this love from the fans to those characters, even though they never saw their faces.
Yeah, I'm so sad that, I think Kenny Baker was the only one that I never got to meet. I did meet Peter Mayhew and I did meet, David Prowse, but, I do not believe I ever got to meet Kenny Baker and Anthony Daniels I met as well. So I have most of the kind of hidden Star Wars, but Boba Fett as well, the original Boba Fett.
And yeah, the day that happened, people were doing there was this picture of all four of them on the set, and someone had photoshopped them as Force ghosts. Really, yeah. Hits you in the heart.
There was the picture that had him, Peter Mayhew, you know, it's Dave Prowse, Peter Mayhew, Kenny Baker, Carrie Fisher, Mark Hamill, and Harrison Ford. And everybody but Mark Hamill and Harrison Ford were done as Force Ghost. And I saw that picture and I lost it. Oh, my goodness. And I mean, I hate to say it, is we do know that these actors are getting older. You know, we do know that we have fewer days with them in front of us than behind us. But it just hurts so much when you're like, this was a person who was there my entire life and now they're not in that same way.
Yeah. Never be forgotten, David Prowse.
Yeah.
All right, let's lighten the mood here. Let's get back, at least get back into the holiday spirit here. We have our first of three holiday movies. We are going back to 1961 for Babes in Toyland, a Christmas movie that has very little Christmas in it.
I believe I counted two uses of the word Christmas, and that is the entirety of the Christmas in this film.
Based off the 1900s musical, which really centered around Christmas. The original musical had a whole song about Christmas, which is not in this movie. But Walt wanted to make a Christmas movie, and this was his idea. But there was a long road to get to this movie. And we talked a bit about of it in previous episodes. This movie was originally supposed to be animated and was supposed to be the follow-up to Lady and the Tramp. Didn't happen, and that ended up being Sleeping Beauty. Good choice, Walt. Good choice. So he passed it on, and he kept it around for a little while. And another project came up, and we've talked about this before. Walt Disney, in the 50s, got the rights to The Wizard of Oz. And he was going to make his movie, The Rainbow Road to Oz, with the Mickey Mouse Club cast, the Mouseketeers, playing all of the central characters. If you haven't seen it yet, there is a 10-minute sketch on YouTube. Just search Walt Disney's Wizard of Oz. And this aired on television. And based off the surviving Mouseketeers, interviewed years later, Walt was not happy with that sketch. Was not happy with the costumes, was not happy with the script, wasn't happy with anything. He approved all the individual pieces, but when he saw all of them put together, it didn't work for him. So he shelved the project. Reworking it, rewriting it, adding songs, deleting songs, trying different characters. Ultimately, he threw the entire project out because it just was not working. And sometimes when a project doesn't work, you just have to let it go. So he went with his plan B, that he already had the rights to Babes in Toyland, and he went with that. Note that this is actually Disney's first live-action musical film. And it says a lot considering what was around at the time. This is the same year that West Side Story came out.
Yeah, this was still when big theatrical musicals were box office gold.
Yeah, we were just a year away from Bye Bye Birdie and The Music Man. And if you want to go with other movies at the time, Blue Hawaii. Though comparing this movie to Blue Hawaii, that's a toss-up.
Yeah, I don't know why you would do that.
It was the only other musical from that era that I could think of.
Yeah. But this does have a lot of similarities with the other Technicolor musicals that were being done in the day. Mm-hmm. It uses a lot of the same tricks. It uses similar color palettes. It uses kind of the same breakup of, and now we will have a giant dance number with 50 dancers.
Mm-hmm.
So it really does feel like this is a Technicolor musical from the height of Technicolor musicals. I'll give it that. You know, it's got that feel.
This being only the second theatrical version of Babes in Toyland ever made, the previous version starred Laurel and Hardy.
Yeah, and Walt got kind of salty about that. We got some Walt salt.
Walt has, I mean, again, why do you think he bought the rights to the entire catalog of Wizard of Oz after the 1939 movie?
Yeah, but Babes in Toyland specifically had something in there, which was they had a character, a guy dressed up in a mouse costume that was specifically meant to look like
Oh,
Mickey.
Wow, yeah, that. I saw that.
And Walt was not happy at this parody of his glorious creation. And Walt was so snippy about it that he bought the rights to Babes in Toyland. And we get two characters in this movie that are meant to parody Laurel and Hardy themselves.
And they're the villains.
And they are the villains. They are the henchmen to the villain. You got the larger one and the skinnier one, and the, you know, that they act in a kind of similar manner sometimes, you know.
The larger one is very braggadocious. The skinny one doesn't talk.
Yeah, I mean, it's there.
All and, we're missing is the skinny one crying like,
yeah, and the only reason we don't get that is because he doesn't make noise. You know, he's using his mime persona there.
And if you're a bit younger than us, you might remember the 1980s version starring a young Drew Barrymore and in his first film role, Keanu Reeves.
Oh, Keanu, I'm so glad you went up from there.
But that's not a Disney movie, so we won't be talking about that. So, yeah, they actually did a television special about this. An episode of Walt's program that they called Backstage Party, which was an attempt to do a fictionalized wrap-up party for the film. Wrap parties, they happen. They're real. But to do a fictionalized wrap party and then film it for your TV show, questionable. It's odd, that's all I'm going to say.
Well, and also all of these kind of staged studio events like this that were kind of advertising for the film, they all have this very cheesy, stilted quality to them that even if the actors in them are good, it's not their usual forte, you know? So it's all like, yeah. Gee, Walt, I am very happy that we could film today, and this party is wonderful. Please have a cupcake, you know?
And they're still in their character costume, so they're completely acting out of character. So you get Ray Bulger still in the Bartimaeus costume, just acting like himself.
Yeah, it's a bit odd. I guess they thought that audiences would not recognize some of these actors if they weren't in their costumes still.
Possible.
I don't know. It was a bit of a different time, and all actors still had a very curated by the studio kind of, you know, we didn't really have the same kind of paparazzi, you know, day in the life or, you know, social media selfie kind of culture. So anytime you would see an actor, it would be like very coiffed headshots or, you know, specifically posed, you know, candid at home, but it's not really their home and they've been dressed by someone and had their makeup done by someone else, you know.
Yeah. So let's get into this movie and who's in it. We've already mentioned one. Let's go with him, Ray Bulger.
All right, Ray Bulger, yeah. Where's Ray Bulger, Bulger okay. When you're doing the dishes? Ray Bulger just cares about Ray Bulger. Sorry. Simpsons jokes are Disney now, and I will do them.
Talk about your Wizard of Oz connection.
Yeah, so Ray Bulger you know best from being the Scarecrow in The Wizard of Oz.
Yeah.
There you go. And Hunk did the farmhand that ends up in Dorothy's Dream. But he was a vaudevillian early in his career. Another one that came up through vaudeville by training. Primarily known as a dancer. He was an amazing dancer, as you'll remember. I mean, the Scarecrow dance and the way his limbs just kind of flop around kind of noodly and everything.
It always hurts me when certain television airings will cut that out.
Oh, it's such a good dance, though. Oh, don't ever cut that out. Ray Bulger was a genius. He had his own show for a while on network television, the Ray Bulger Show, in the early 50s. You know, he was one of those kind of character actors that was always kind of around. There is something interesting from the filming of Wizard of Oz that actually shows up in Babes in Toyland.
Hmm.
Which is, there was a massive problem with the makeup on Wizard of Oz. If you know anything about trivia about Wizard of Oz, you'll know that the Tin Man was originally played by Buddy Ebsen, who would go on to be Jed Clampett in Beverly Hillbillies. He was cast in that part, and they put him in the silver makeup, and it almost killed him.
They used actual silver in the makeup.
I don't remember what chemical it actually was that they used, but whatever it was, it like hurt his lungs. He had a violent skin reaction to it. He had all sorts of allergic reactions to it, and it just didn't work. So the interesting thing is that they had to replace him. Well, Ray Bulger had a sort of similar but less horrific and life-threatening reaction to the makeup for the Scarecrow. And after he was done, the makeup and the kind of appliances they glued to him and stuff like that left very deep kind of scarring on his face. Ooh. So if you watch the close-ups in Babes in Toyland, which is 22 years later that he filmed it, you can still see that he's got like incredibly deep, what look like age lines, but they're in odd sections of his face. It's injury from the makeup, from the Scarecrow makeup. So, it's kind of fascinating that two of the actors that were attached to that movie had massive debilitating reactions to the makeup. But the interesting thing about Ray Bulger in Babes in Toyland is this was the first time in his long career by this point, he'd been in the business for decades, that he had ever been cast in a villainous role. Everybody loved Ray Bulger. He was a comedian. He was a good guy. He was kind of a dork, you know. But nobody ever thought of him as a villain, so to see him as the main villain was kind of shocking, you know? It's not what you would expect.
Playing the villain Barnaby, which never stated in the movie, but he's supposed to be the crooked man, the once a crooked man who lived in a crooked little house. He had a crooked mouse.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the way they designed Barnaby's mansion is very... kind of tell the people, oh, he's the crooked man because everything's slanted, everything's off kilter, even his telescope is crooked.
Yeah.
So, let's move on. We got Tommy Sands as Tom Piper. Never stated in the movie, but in the original play, he's actually the son of the Pied Piper.
Yeah, but he's also based on the Tom the Piper's son stole a pig in a way he did run that. Poem as well.
Yeah.
A lot of these are mixtures of various children's rhymes, kids' stories, fables.
It is Mother Goose Land, after all, so.
Yeah. So, Tommy Sands, he was a teen idol at the time. I mean, that's why he ended up. He started out on an episode of Kraft Television Theater, and he got the nickname The Singing Idol. And he was known for doing all that kind of teeny bopper songs throughout the 50s and early 60s. Later on... he gets a contract with 20th Century Fox, and they think he's going to be the next Elvis Presley, that he's going to be the singer who really hits it in movies, and his first movie immediately flops. So that's how he ended up at the Disney Corporation later on. But he, you know, we've already mentioned him before that because he was on set with Annette Funicello, the two of them sing the theme song to The Parent Trap.
Yeah, get your money's worth, Walt.
The interesting thing is that, he married Nancy Sinatra. He was married to Nancy Sinatra when he filmed this film. That is Frank Sinatra's daughter. The interesting thing is that they were married for like 4 or 5 years, and after they divorced, he couldn't seem to get a role in Hollywood. And there were some kind of behind-the-scenes speculation that maybe Frank had used some of his connections to get good old Tommy blacklisted. But TV was there, and Tommy ended up doing a lot of kind of guest starring roles in... like Wagon Train Bonanza. He did a lot of westerns on TV there, sort of at the end of his career. But he never really recovered from whatever happened after his divorce.
You're in the family, you're always in the family. You don't leave the family.
Yeah. But the, It was kind of interesting that he went from kind of, you know, really big into the teen idol was going to be the next Elvis, and then just kind of petered out, unfortunately.
Unfortunate.
Yeah.
So let's move on to the legend, the original Mouseketeer, Annette Funicello.
Yeah, I mean, what can you really say about her that everybody doesn't already know? You know, I mean, she...
the beach idol.
Yeah, I mean, she really did...
peanut butter spokesperson.
That's true. But Most people know her as an original Mouseketeer, of course. The most popular of the original Mouseketeers, easily.
To the point where she got her own segment on the show that was just her.
Yeah, I'm not really sure how the other Mouseketeers felt about that, but yeah, they really started pushing her. And then she went on to do movies like Beach Party, you know. She looked really good in a bathing suit, so they used
that. Ricky Avalon agreed.
Yeah, she really, you know, they teamed her up with Frankie Avalon quite a lot, and they became, you know, Annette and Frankie, and, you know, that was a duo there that made a lot of money for a long time. But she had a really long career. I mean, she really did. It's kind of interesting that even after the peak of her career, she would show up now and then. She kind of semi-retired when she had kids, because she wanted to be a full-time mom for a while and really enjoy when her kids were young. But she would, you know, people would pull her back for cameos now and then. And so
especially
if you watch
Disney, Disney loved bringing her back.
Yeah, that's true. Most of it was for Disney, but she also showed up on like Love Boat and Love American Style and Fantasy Island, and, you know, all those kind of shows at the time.
I'm gonna be honest, seeing Annette Funicello interact with the 90s Musketeers was pretty cool.
Yeah, they did bring her back for that, and that was really interesting. The sad part about her life is that she ended up being diagnosed with multiple sclerosis, and a lot of her later years, she was in a great deal of pain. And she tried to hide it as much as she could, because she didn't want her fans, I guess, to think of her.
Remember her as her as she was, not as she is, kind of.
Yeah, but the thing is that people spoke very well of her to the end of her life. She's one of those people that you don't really hear people who knew her say bad things about her. And even at the kind of, you know, right at the end when she was in the most pain and suffering the most kind of debilitating part of her illness, she was said to be kind to people and really go out of her way to make other people have a happy time when they were. And I think that was kind of part of the growing up with the Disney brand ingrained in her, you know. Yeah. You always want to put on that happy, yeah, happy face.
Of course, playing Mary Quite Contrary. That's actually her name. Her middle name is Quite. They literally refer to her as Miss Mary Quite Contrary. Middle name Quite.
Yeah.
Yeah, let's move on to Ed Wynn, another Disney legend as a toy maker.
Yeah, Ed Wynn is probably most legendary for being the Mad Hatter.
Also in Mary Poppins.
And also, uncle. You know, later in Mary Poppins, yeah, after he made Babes in Toyland, he'd be back, yeah, for Mary Poppins. He would be back later for That Darn Cat.
Mm-hmm.
And he would be back for Absent-Minded Professor, because that movie also starred his son, Keenan Wynn. Mm. His final film role was actually in a Disney production, a movie called The Gnome Mobile.
Hmm.
But it was actually released posthumously because he died between filming it and the release. He was also in the Golden Horseshoe Review at Disneyland for a while. So, you know, a long, long career with Disney. But of course, he started out in vaudeville and then went to radio and then moved on to film. So he had a kind of typical career trajectory. And then by the time he hooked up with Disney, he kind of stayed working with Disney, came back. But his voice and his look on screen was so well known that he got a lot of parodies. He shows up in some Betty Boop shorts and some Merry Melodies cartoons as a parody.
Yeah.
As a parody. It's not really him, but it's people trying to play an Edwin character.
I want to talk about him the next one. Tommy Kirk as Grumio the Assistant.
Yeah.
Another Disney legend, because he did several Disney films, some of them with Annette Funicello.
Yeah, he started as a Disney legend, and he's still with us. He's kicking along. He's 78 now, but as of this recording, still with us. He started on a high and has not maintained that, I think, is a kind way to say that.
Young actors, you either mature and get new roles, or you just peter out. There really is no middle ground.
Yeah.
I want to note here, Tommy Kirk, as I we've talked about Wizard of Oz, Tommy Kirk was actually supposed to play the villain in Rainbow Road to Oz, playing the Wicked Witch of the West Sun.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So he was already signed for this movie, technically.
Yeah, sort of. He was with this movie before it was this movie. Form. Yeah. You know him best as the kid in Old Yeller.
Yeah.
Old Yeller is his dog, much to everyone's chagrin. Speaking of dog movies, he's also in Shaggy Dog. And then he's also one of the sons in Swiss Family Robinson. But he was, he auditioned for a segment on Mickey Mouse Club, which was Hardy Boys. They did Hardy Boys on Mickey Mouse Club.
The mystery novel, not the professional wrestlers.
Yes. The old, you know, as in the Hardy Boys and the Nancy Drew mysteries. Yeah. But he really, though, came to prominence for Old Yeller. That was kind of the thing that really put him on the map. And then Disney kept him on, you know, got, like I said, Shaggy Dog and Swiss Family Robinson. He also shows up in Absent-Minded Professor. I mean, he was in Disney films constantly in the 50s and 60s. He worked with Annette Funicello again in The Misadventures of Merlin Jones.
Yeah, playing love interests.
Yeah, so even though they're not... even though they're not love interests in this film, they would be later in the other. But he didn't really have the happiest of childhoods, he says, at the Disney Corporation. And that was because he was a homosexual. And unfortunately, you know, gays in the 50s and 60s, I mean, Hollywood was slightly nicer, but if you wanted to be a star, you had to be super in the closet. And unfortunately, when they were filming Misadventures of Merlin Jones, he met a boy and he started dating that boy. And that boy's mother discovered it and contacted Disney. And Disney fired him.
But they did bring him back because they made a sequel to The Misadventures of Merlin Jones called The Monkey's Uncle.
Yeah, I mean, it's...
Unless they were already filming that at the time.
Yeah, it was... Monkey's Uncle came out in 65, and he was fired around 63, 64. They fired him, but they had already started pre-production, and Walt asked him to return for one more go because the Merlin Jones films were really, really, really profitable, and Walt was willing to kind of bend that decision for one more go. And I guess Kurt needed money because he had just gotten fired. Unfortunately, because of this and some drug issues later on, his film career kind of went downhill. He ended up doing a lot of work with Burt I. Gordon. And if you are a Mystery Science Theater fan, your ears just perked up. He was also in another movie called Catalina Caper, which if you are a Mystery Science Theater fan, your ears just perked up. He did some other movies that were not on Mystery Science Theater, but were not great.
Blockbusters, they were not.
Yeah, well, yeah, he did a lot of, like, really cheesy films, you know, B-movies and stuff. But anyway, probably deserved better than he got, and it's very unfortunate why the Disney Corporation fired him. And I hope he got an apology eventually. If not, the Disney Corporation should maybe apologize.
So let's talk about our parody characters. Henry Calvin as Gonzago and Gene Sheldon as Rodrigo. We talked about them. We talked about Zorro.
Yeah, you'll remember Henry Calvin as he was Garcia, mm-hmm. Sergeant Garcia in Zorro. And Gene Sheldon was Bernardo, who was Don Diego's mute servant, also in Zorro. So back again, don't really need to talk about them much. There is kind of one interesting thing is, I believe this is the first appearance of actress Ann Gillan
as Little Bo Peep.
As Little Bo Peep, and she would go on to be the character of Dainty June in the film version of Gypsy, the musical. I hate that this show keeps making me say that word over and over, and we'll get to that.
Yeah.
But she's also in an amazing episode of Twilight Zone called Mute, which is about a girl who was raised entirely telepathically, and then her parents die and she's put into the normal world where people speak out loud, and she can't really handle it. But it's kind of, she had a kind of interesting career, lots of TV, some voiceover work, but yeah, that's kind of what most people, know her for, at least in her childhood work.
Anyone else you want to put a spotlight on of this cast?
No, most of the other ones, are kind of, you know, interesting character actors, but, not anybody, that I feel like spotlighting at this point in time.
Let's get to the movie proper then, because this is straight up done as a straight stage play, because you get a curtain, and, our first character we see is Sylvester Goose, the pet goose of Mother Goose. Why Mother Goose has a pet goose, I don't know.
Well, she's got to have a goose. She's Mother Goose. What would she be a mother to if she doesn't have a goose?
Yeah. Sylvester here is a very sarcastic goose, even shaming the weight of poor Mother Goose here.
Yeah, which, like, given the weight that they say she is, I'm like, shut up, Goose. I will make dinner out of you.
And we meet the titular Mother Goose herself, who invites us to go to her home, Mother Goose Land, for the marriage of Tom and Mary. And we get a big production number about how awesome it is to live in Mother Goose Land. And we see a bunch of Mother Goose characters. Little Boy Blue, we see Little Bo Peep, Jack and Jill, Simple Simon, Jack B. Nimble. And a bunch of other characters that might be familiar, but they're never named. Like, we see a pumpkin house, so I assume it's, you know, Peter Pumpkin Eater and stuff like that. They need a shoe. There's no shoe on this set. I feel bad. There needs to be a shoe. There's old Mother Hubbard on it.
Here's an interesting thing. When we talk about these Disney productions from, especially from the 50s and 60s, I always kind of ask my dad for his thoughts, because this was his era of Disney and he was a Disney fan at the time. You know, he watched the TV specials and watched the movies on TV, and he was even at Disney World in the first month, I think it was open. It was right at the opening that he got there. So he was one of the first through the gates. But he told me that one of the things he got in his rewatch was that the set decoration for the most of the, like, Mother Goose Land, it goes a little bit into Toyland, but especially in the Mother Goose segments, really feels like it's a small world.
Yeah.
The way things are painted, the color schemes, the kind of, it feels like the, like, you know, sort of Switzerland part of of it's a lot small. Of
the definitely dressed like Holland dancers, and I get that it's supposed to look like a storybook. I have to question that decision. I mean, I get it, but it's
this is
your for your first attempt at a live action movie musical compared to what else was out there at the time. It feels a little cheap, even though Disney is clearly putting a lot of money into this.
Yeah.
Is expensively cheap a term?
Yes. There are some things where you're like, how did they spend that much money to look that garbage? And this is one of those things. You were talking about it looks so different from what else was out there at the time. And like I said, I asked my father his opinions on this movie, and he said, you know, if this movie had come out 4 years earlier, it's probably a big hit. But this movie tanked, and it's probably because it came out in 1961.
Again, West Side Story had come out just a few months prior and became the biggest movie of the year. So we have to compare this to West Side Story. You can't.
Well, but also think about what was going on in 1961. I mean, Kennedy was already president. You already had the a lot of the civil rights movement starting up pretty heavily by this point. You know, we're already, like, past the death of Emmett Till and things like that that really sparked the, you know, you've already got Martin Luther King Jr. as a growing figure in the land and everything. So what in the world is this movie doing with its lily white cast?
Yeah.
In its perfectly Aryan village. I mean, this is such a white bread movie.
But that's the thing. Who do you change the color of for these characters? You know, do you have a black Little Boy Blue? Do you have a black Simple Simon?
I'm not even talking about that. But, like, you know, I mean, most of these stories are from Europe. And despite what certain people would tell you, Europe has been a multi-ethnic place for, you know, like a thousand or more years. Okay, it's fine. It's okay to show other ethnicities coexisting in an early time period.
You're talking about the company that did Song of the South.
Exactly. And it really shows in this film. But imagine, as weird as it looks to us today, we can go like, well, it's an old film. old films were all lily white, but it's like in 1961, as people are protesting and boycotting, and every night on the nightly news is racial tension, and then Disney gives you like, come see the whitest kids in town dance on screen in the most toothless musical you have ever seen in your life.
Imagine if this came out this year.
Yeah, it would be like releasing it this year. It's like, it's that, you know, it's like releasing a Shirley Temple movie right now. It's just like, it does not work. That is my problem with this film overall, is this is such a toothless film. And you can say like, well, it's supposed to be for kids, but the play it is based on is for adults.
There is murder, there is crime, there is people getting framed for murder. That's core story element of the original musical, and that is completely eliminated in this story.
Yeah, and a lot of that survived in Laurel and Hardy film, too.
Yeah.
You know, that movie was aimed at adults. This movie is for, like, four-year-olds. I don't know who this movie is for.
Walt Disney. Whenever that comes up, like it's the audience of one mentality, and there's a lot of it. There's a lot of Hollywood pictures that are like that. They were made for one person, and that's it. The studio likes it, and that's it.
I don't even know how Walt could have liked this, to be honest with you.
I don't think he did in the end. Years later, he would do Mary Poppins and completely change the game.
Yeah, but it's obvious that they were trying to go for like a younger teen audience, maybe, because you got Annette Funicello and Tommy Sands, who were teen idols at this point. You know, this was like, they didn't really have the tween bit there, but this was kind of what the tweens were into.
And this is also during that era that would go into like the early 80s, where teenagers wouldn't be caught dead in a Disney movie.
Yeah, this was already past the point where you aged out of Disney. We don't really think about that anymore because millennials have kind of put our foot down and it's like, no, you are not taking Disney from us. But
you are not taking Beauty and the Beast and Aladdin and Little Mermaid away from me.
Yeah, but there was a point in time, and this was in the middle of where it wasn't cool to like Disney past a certain age.
Yeah.
To be honest, Annette Funicello and Tommy Sands were like kind of the people who would appeal to the very last age group that would admit to liking Disney. But at the same time, you know, if you remember being that age, you remember that you kind of wanted to act a little older than you were. You didn't want things too babyish.
Yeah.
You weren't ready for anything hardcore or, you know, super violent or anything, but at the same time, you did want a little edge there. You wanted to feel cool.
A little dose of reality in your fiction.
Yeah, but this is 100% baby's first bedtime story.
Yeah, yeah. And again, I saw this as a kid on the Disney Channel, so I was the right age watching this. So it does have a little bit of a soft spot for it. But as you grow old, as I grew older, it's like, there is just so much wrong with this movie. There is just very little plot in this movie.
Yeah, I mean, let's kind of short version the plot here, if I may.
All right.
Because there is very little plot and quite a lot of musical number. Because this is based off an operetta.
Mm.
So very little talking, very lot of singing, but the basic plot is that Mary and Tom are going to be married, and somehow Barnaby, the villain, finds out that Mary is the heir to a fortune and will be told about it when she marries.
Not unusual for the era that they're trying to go for, but how would Barnaby know that?
Yeah, we don't exactly know how Barnaby knows this, and also I don't know that Mary ever knows this.
I don't think Mary knows it either. It's implied. Yeah. It's implied later in the film that Barnaby works at the bank, so maybe that's how he found out.
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely super rich and has ties to whatever banking community there is in Mother Goose Land, but, you know, whatever. Barnaby wants her money, because even though he's the richest guy in town, greed.
More money.
Yeah.
I love that Barnaby breaks the fourth wall to tell the audience his evil plan.
That is the weirdest thing, because you get two fourth wall breaks, and at first it starts with the goose talking to the audience before the curtains open, and that's fine. Like, a lot of times in plays, there is a narrator who comes out and says something. And then, a couple of minutes into the movie, when we are introduced to Barnaby, he looks at the audience and he's like, "Hi, by the way, I'm a villain. She's going to inherit a lot of money. I want it. Now you know the story. Back to the film." And then, never again does anyone talk to the camera.
Mm-hmm.
It is a plot contrivance that is entirely dropped after the first 5 minutes of this film. And I'm like, if you're going to do fourth wall jokes, do them. I'm fine with that as a plot device.
I would have liked it if it was just Sylvester breaking the fourth wall. Like, he would turn to the camera and say something and say, "Who are you talking to?" "No one."
Yeah, but they never do. The goose just goes back to being a talking goose in the story and only talks to the other characters, never talks to the audience again. And the same thing with Barnaby. Barnaby acknowledges the audience once at the beginning and then doesn't. And I'm like, that would have made the movie better if one of these two characters kept acknowledging the audience.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't. They just drop it. It's like a one-off joke for both characters. Anyway, Barnaby wants to marry Mary. So he sends his henchmen, Gonzorgo and Rodrigo, to kidnap Tom and throw him into the ocean and drown him.
And probably my favorite song in this play is the villain song, "We Won't Be Happy Till We Get It."
Yeah, they do a good musical number for the henchmen. I will admit that some of the musical numbers on their own are kind of interesting.
They are based off the original songs from the operetta, but because it's Disney and they like to change everything, they change the lyrics of pretty much every song, save for the song Toyland.
And quite a few of the like tempos and settings of this, they completely kind of butchered the operetta. But instead of throwing him into the sea and drowning him, they decide to double dip a payday. And they say, "Hey, there's a camp of Romani." I'm not saying the word again. "There is a camp of Romani over there. And we hear that they buy babies because we're racist. So why don't we go sell Tom?" Not a baby, but they go for it anyway. "Why don't we go sell Tom to this camp of Romani, and they will pay us, and then we'll go back and tell Barnaby that we've drowned him, and Barnaby will pay us, and then we get double the payday." So they
kidnap Tom, literally bonk him on the head.
With a mallet.
Because it's a Disney movie. Yeah, so they kidnap him. One thing I do love
is
that
he sees stars, too.
Yes. Cause
and Disney I kind of wanted to go, like, what is tweeting birdies? Tweeting birdies? No, it's the stars. Anyway.
I'm ready for my close-up, Raul.
Yeah.
I do love, okay, because obviously he's left Mary's house for getting married. They were supposed to be married the next day, and he has this flower, and he's smelling, and he's all being romantic, and he's in love, and he gets hit in the head with the mallet, and then as they put him in the sack, Rodrigo gives him the flower and has him holding the flower as he's in the sack.
He's just holding the flower, which I kind of like. There are some really good visual gags that are like, you know, taken as a clip on YouTube or something. You would go like, "Heh, that's funny." But in the course of the film, that's kind of all you get for comedy, in my opinion.
Gene Sheldon is pretty much the comedy in this movie.
Yeah.
The running gag of his one leg being longer than the other.
Yeah, that's a weird one. And it really is just because the guy playing Rodrigo is trained as a mime and doesn't speak during the movie. So he does all these kind of really cheesy mime bits that were already really cheesy mime bits in the 60s. Like, if you see what mimes were doing in the 60s, and then you see what this guy is doing, you're like, oh, wow, that is ancient jokes. Anyway.
Yeah, so, yeah, let's get back here. Next day, Mary's about to try on her wedding dress because she's getting married the next day. And Barnaby is there to congratulate the happy couple, but, you know, no one likes him because he's the rich a-hole. Everyone in town knows he's an a-hole. And he's proud to be an a-hole, but he wants to give his congratulations to Tom and Mary on their upcoming wedding. Coincidentally, as Gonzago and Rodrigo return to town to announce that Tom's dead. He drowned in the sea, and we're sailors, and we sailed with him.
Yeah.
With this bogus letter to Mary saying, I'm poor, and I am going to go into the sea to get my fortune. You should totally marry the rich a-hole that everyone knows is an a-hole for no other reason because he's rich and he can take care of you. That sounds so much like Tom.
Yeah, it's exactly what Tom sounded like before he disappeared. Yeah. And Mary buys it. Yeah, because she's not very bright, as we'll see in a moment.
Yeah.
But Barnaby's there. He's like, hey, Tom had a good idea. You should marry me. I mean, I am your landlord, and I would kick you out of your house if you didn't marry me. That's not a threat, but I'm just saying.
And then he sings about a castle in Spain, which, again, song from the original play, lyrics changed, tempo changed to be more Spanish, and we need to have Ray Bulger sing, because when you have your Ray Bulger, you need your Ray Bulger to dance.
Yeah, well, I will say that this is easily my favorite part of the movie. Everything about this sequence works for me. The dancing is superb. And bravo to Annette Funicello for keeping up with Ray Bulger, who is one of the better dancers in film history.
I love that, you know, she's completely against marrying him, completely, you know, rejecting his, she is rejecting his advances, but she's also going along with the dance.
Well, yeah, but it's a good dance.
but she tries to stop him, and then he takes her hand, and they start to tango, and she just goes with it.
This is the closest this film comes to having a moral, is this song. Because as a villain song, I am almost, not quite, but almost willing to call this a lost Disney classic of villain songs. Not quite.
There's only one known cover of this song, and that was by Buster Poindexter sometime in the 80s.
This song is so good in the Rich People Are Evil Kids, which is a genre of music very close to my heart. It is so good just hearing this guy talk about all the stuff he has, but he just wants a couple of pennies more.
Yeah. And if you marry me, you'll live like a queen forever. And you'll have everything you could ever want. You'll have cake every day. You'll wear the finest gowns.
Such a shallow idea of happiness.
Yeah.
It is such a shallow materialistic idea of happiness. And it's so beautifully rendered. You know, I mean, Ray Bulger really sells this song. He's got a cape that he uses to, like, ensnare her and lead her around the dance floor. I mean, this is brilliantly choreographed. Mm-hmm. And he puts those Cuban heels to work, baby. He is wearing some death heels on that dance floor, and they are gorgeous. But really, really good song, and they do a really cool bit of choreography with the fountain in the town square.
Yeah.
That really kind of has that Disney touch that you would still see at the parks if you're near a water feature in the parks. I kind of love everything about this scene in a bubble. Like, take this scene and package it in a bubble separate from the rest of the film. This scene really works.
Yeah, and and Mary says no. She's not going to marry for money. She's going to marry for love, which Barnaby doesn't like because he's the villain. But we also get the announcement that Little Bo Peep's sheep, and she doesn't. Little Bo Peep's sheep has disappeared, and she doesn't know where to find them.
And it's because the henchmen have stolen them.
And we get another Mother Goose character, Bobby Shafto, who tells him that he saw the sheep go into the forest of no return.
Ooh.
Poor Bobby Shafto. He gets like one line in this movie, and he's already a lesser known nursery rhyme.
Yeah. So you're saying Bobby Shafto got the shaft?
Yeah.
I'm just talking about Bobby Shafto.
Can you dig it?
So, yeah. I love the idea of the Forest of No Return. I just love when movies are so absolutely obvious. Like, we know this is stupid, but we're going to do it anyway.
You are going to go into the Forest of Eternal Damnation.
Yeah. So here's the thing we haven't talked about. There are these children that we keep seeing, like Bo Peep and
Little Boy Blue.
Wee
Willie Winky,
like,
who is always wearing pajamas because he's Willie Winky, which is odd because there's a scene where all the characters are in pajamas, so Winky is just in his regular clothes.
Yeah, he never changes this whole film. But
all these kids live with Mary.
Yeah, Mary is like their mom or something. They live in her house in like one room in a bunk bed for like six kids.
So it's weird that Mary, quite contrary, is like the foster mother of Little Bo Peep, Little Boy Blue, Willie Winky, and these two unnamed twin girls.
Yeah. I don't.
They don't even have names. Like, we don't know what nursery rhyme they're from. They're just known as the twins.
Yeah. I'm thinking maybe somebody should have told her that was why Tom ran away, because like, you've already got six kids. What the heck, girl? You know, where did all these kids come from? But then we get what is my least favorite song in the film.
Don't Cry, Bo Peep?
No, that's before.
Oh, I Can't Do the Sum.
I Can't Do the Freaking Sum.
Because that's what you need in your Disney family film, a movie about taxes.
Well, no, it's a song about how girls can't math.
Yeah.
Where she calls herself stupid because she can't math. It's like, okay, look, I can't math and I fully admit it, but that is because I have a learning disability. It has nothing to do with my sex or my gender. But this whole song is like, what is a poor girl to do? There's just so many numbers in the world. My head hurts now.
And this
what
song,
is bread?
This song is from the original operetta, but the meaning is completely different. Again, this is one of those things that Disney decided, let's rewrite this entire song.
Yeah, if this song was honestly about how it starts out, like, taxes are high and bread and milk keep going up in price, and I, no matter how much I work, I can't make it ends meet. Which goes along with the Rich People Are Evil song that we just heard.
Yeah. Barnaby just saying that he's just threatened to evict her.
Could have been a really great, like, commentary on class.
Yeah.
But instead it turns into, like, what a silly little girl. She can't do numbers.
And this whole song is an acid trip, especially when you have five Annettes.
Yeah, they use that kind of doubling green screen technology to have like various versions of Annette Funicello singing to herself. Which is kind of cool in a... It's got a very Winnie the Pooh pink elephant vibe.
Yeah.
You know the acid trippy scene in Winnie the Pooh where there's like the effalumps and woozles or whatever?
Yeah.
It feels kind of like that, except all of the elephants are Annette Funicello.
Yeah. And so since she can't do math, she decides, well, if I can't pay my bills, I don't have a choice. I'm going to marry Barnaby. To which the kids, who apparently have been eavesdropping this whole time, saying, well, if we get the sheep back, then she won't have to marry Barnaby because the sheep are our sole source of income.
Yeah. So
how much wool are they selling off these sheep?
Yeah, so off to the forest of instant death they go.
All right. I got to pause this because I do have to backtrack. What the hell did they do to these sheep? Because when we first see the sheep, they're all in different colors.
Yeah, they are multicolored sheep, which I don't remember being in any of the Mother Goose fairy tales.
Yeah.
But, like, seriously, this is like they did some, like, Kool-Aid dye on the wool or something. Except this was the Disney Corporation in the 60s, so it's probably, like, lead paint.
This is the same company that forced lemmings off of British to film it for a documentary.
This is probably, like, those sheep died in agony the next day from that coloration. Because we never see the sheep again.
No.
We see that first scene where they lead in the multicolored sheep and they're like, look, Bo Peep has a bunch of sheep. And then we never see the sheep again. They're a major plot point. We never see the sheep. I am a sheep truther. Tell me what happened to those sheep, Disney.
Yes. So the kids are going off to the Forest of No Return to find the sheep. Meanwhile, Barnaby has awakened the entire town and in the middle of the night to announce that he's going to marry Mary. Which is odd because when you first see them, you see a lot of people in their pajamas. But like one camera cut later and they're all in their regular clothing.
Also, I did not realize watching the film that it was supposed to be nighttime because it is like noon.
Again, these kids in pajamas going to bed. Afternoon nap, maybe?
I don't know, but like it is bright as heck outside.
Day for night.
Yeah.
Which doesn't make any sense because this is a stage.
Yeah. And very obviously so.
Yeah. So as part of the celebration, Barnaby has hired these traveling Romani performers to perform for the town. And it just happens to be the exact same people that Gonzago and Rodrigo had sold Tom to.
Yeah.
They should have just left town.
Granted,
they haven't been paid yet, but they should have just left town.
Yeah, it's not worth it, boys. Keep running. So we get a whole big dance number and everything where it's like, hey, look, the entertainers have come to town. Yay. And then they bring out a Vardo. And they bring out a Vardo, and inside the Vardo, they say, is a woman named Floretta, who is an old woman who is a fortune teller and psychic who knows everything about the past and the future and will tell you your fortune.
And this movie makes it very clear, because we get a cut into it, and there is Tom putting on makeup, on a costume, he's putting a fake nose on, putting on a wig, to let the audience know, yeah, this is Tom's plan. So at one point, Tom regained consciousness, told the Romani people what's going on, and said, yeah, we'll help you out. We don't want the guy anyway.
Yeah, which, I mean, bravo that, you know, that they do this. But anyway,
This
is also kind of a pretty decent number. And Tommy Sands sells this.
His falsetto is really good.
Yeah, I mean, he hardcore sells this character of this old woman who goes around saying, like, goes up to Mary and tells her fortune is that she really loves Tom. Tom is alive and you're going to marry him. And then he goes up to the villain and he's like, Barnaby is the worst thing that ever walked the earth and he's going to get his comeuppance real soon.
And it's one of my favorite songs in the movie. Racial overtones withstanding, it's just that entire thing of here's a guy that everyone thinks is dead and he's getting his comeuppance by just acting in such a way, and like it's a big con and he's trying to con the con man pretty much. And that's why I like it so much.
Yeah, I mean, again, like in a different context, there are parts of this that really work. But in the context, it's kind of like it's less than the sum of its parts.
At the end of the song, Tommy takes the costume off to reveal that Tom is alive. Yay! Goodbye, Florida. Hello, Tom.
And the whole town rejoices because everybody likes Tom and everybody hates Barnaby.
Yeah.
And so Barnaby now is like, curses, you have foiled me, and he runs away, but not too far because he's still got some plotting and scheming left in him.
And they follow Tom and Mary as they find a note from the kid saying, we're going to go into the forest of death to get the sheep back so you don't have to bury Barnaby. So if they had just stayed put, this movie would never have happened.
Yeah. I will remind you that we are like halfway into Babes in Toyland at this point, and we have not even heard the word Toyland spoken by any of the characters.
Yeah.
So into the forest we go.
Let's talk about these trees.
Yeah, there are talking trees and they are evil. And kidnap people and tell them you can't go back. This is why it's the forest of no return. You are trespassing on the trees' territory and the trees will not let you leave.
What are these acid trip trees? Like the trees in freaking Wizard of Oz from 30 years earlier look better than this.
Yeah, it is a very Wizard of Oz setup where they kind of have like a mouth slit cut in the trunk and there's a performer inside that like flaps the except it's really, really bad.
Voices of the Mellow Men. So we got Thurl Ravenscroft as one of the trees.
Yeah, it really is. And you can tell at one point, you can tell which is Thurl Ravenscroft. You're like, oh yeah, yeah.
There's a few mess ups in here because at one point, one of the tree's eyebrows malfunctions and it's like in front of his face and they do nothing about it and they keep the shot in the movie.
No, one of the things that you notice if you're actually paying attention is in most of the dance sequences, there are moments where the dance goes completely wrong and they didn't refilm it. And you talk about the expensive cheapness. There it is. It's like, you threw so much money at this movie, Disney, you couldn't just retake that scene? Like, that's the take you went with?
Also, there are shots where Little Bo Peep loses her cane. Like, in one shot, she has it in her hand, in another shot, she doesn't have it.
Yeah, it's the disappearing, reappearing shepherd's crook through the whole film. It's just like, some scenes she has it, and then some scenes she doesn't, and then some scenes she'll be standing there, and in one shot she'll have it, and then it'll edit from a different angle, and she won't in the same scene. Yeah, it's weird. I guess the actor kept forgetting her prop, and nobody was keeping track of continuity.
Also, the puppeting in, not just of the trees, but of Sylvester, the lip flaps of the puppet does not match what they're saying.
Well, okay. In Sylvester, I can sort of give it a bit of a pass. I thought the Sylvester puppet was brilliant. Because
that's
actually
Mary McCarty as Mother Goose puppeting Sylvester.
Yeah, so the actress playing Mother Goose has a fake half of her body. And her real arm is hidden inside the goose and working the mouth of the goose. And then there's a built-up kind of arm over it and a fake hand that loops under the goose to make it look like she's carrying the goose.
Her arm must have been so tired.
It is, yeah. It's gotta be, like, that is some, like, you know, Big Bird level puppeteering skill to me. But, like, I really respect the actress because she is really good with the puppet. The way the puppet, like, keeps looking around, responding to other characters, it'll, like, when the goose gets scared, he'll, like, hide his head in her neck and stuff like that. It's a really good puppeteering job. But the mouth flaps of the puppet I think she was just miming. I don't know if there was anybody on set, like, speaking the lines, but all the dialogue is piped in afterwards because the actual puppeteer performer is not providing the voice.
Mm-hmm.
So she just kind of flaps as what she thinks the lines are supposed to be. And then somebody came in and did a voice later. So I can forgive in that instance that those don't really match up. But
the trees.
But the trees were dancing to a recording of this song. It should have had vocal performances in it.
Mm-hmm. Playback.
Yeah. Why are you not matching to those vocal performances? So yeah, I'll agree with you on the trees, but I'm kind of giving the Mother Goose puppeteer a bit of leeway on hers, because that cannot have been easy to do.
I could see that, like, Mother Goose costume being like at a convention, someone just walking around dressed as Mother Goose with a goose that just looks at people and just maybe not talking but just looks around and reacting to things.
Oh my goodness, that would be awesome. I kind of want to do that costume now, except different. Like, I would like to do it with, like, you know, a dragon or something. But a similar
thing. Have you ever heard of the Dreamfinder?
No.
I think you can pull off the Dreamfinder and Figment.
Oh, yeah. Dreamfinder and Figment would be, yeah, okay. Until you said Figment, I kind of forgot. But yeah, you're right. That would be an interesting, I don't know. I'd love to do a puppeteering costume at some point. Anyway, so
let's get back to the film. As Tom and Mary, after the trees had their big you're captured, you're not going anywhere song, Tom and Mary find them, but it's apparently later than they thought. They can't get back. So they're going to camp there, just sleep out in the open woods with no tent or anything.
Also, can we believe children, please?
Yeah,
They get there and the children are like, hi, by the way, the trees are evil. And the reason we haven't come home yet is because the trees trapped us here and will not let us leave. And the Tom and Mary characters are just like, aw, silly children, stop saying nonsense, even though we just talked to a talking goose 5 minutes ago.
Yeah. So they are all asleep and, Barnaby and his cronies catch up to them, and they say, oh, we're going to wait for sunrise to get them. They can't get them now while they're asleep, but they're going to get them when they wake up.
Yeah, this is ridiculous.
Flaw in the plan, Barnaby.
Yeah, so they're just deciding to, you know, like, oh, they look so cute when they're asleep, so we'll just sit here and wait for them to wake up. But they're woken up by the trees, who it turns out are alive, because that's what the children said. Maybe listen to children when they tell you things.
And part of the thing about being in the forest is that the trees are not just the trees. They are the apparently the police force for Toyland.
Yeah, this is trespassing not necessarily on the land of the trees, but on the land that belongs to Toyland. So you have to go see the sheriff of Toyland, who is the toy maker.
Yeah.
And this is the first time we hear about Toyland. This is well over an hour into an hour and a half movie. Toyland.
And we get the song Toyland, the only mostly unchanged song from the original operetta. But it's only the chorus, and they've changed it from a lullaby to a march.
Toyland, Toyland, I hate everything about this song. It is grating and annoying, and I kind of want to smack anybody who sings it.
Yeah, again, yeah.
I do not like this song. It is annoying.
So they make it to Toyland, and again, Barnaby could have easily got them a set at that point, but said, we're going to wait till nightfall.
Well, who wants to fight a bunch of talking trees?
But the trees have already left. They're already in Toyland.
Oh, yeah, they're just kind of hanging out outside of a window watching the toy maker. That's right. I forgot that. And then, so, like,
our Toyland heroes, is just, yeah, Toyland is just a giant toy factory. That's it.
Yeah, our heroes are standing there watching through the windows of Toyland, and our villains are, like, 5 feet behind them, watching them watch through the windows of Toyland. Nobody knows they're there. Just snatch them right now.
Yeah.
Why are you waiting? This is this is ridiculous. Be better villains.
So now we get a completely different movie because we now have the toy maker and his assistant, Grumio. I hate the toy maker. He is my least favorite character in this movie, even more than Barnaby.
He's annoying and condescending.
He's the real villain to this movie for me. Now, at least Barnaby is honest about his evilness. The toy maker is, like I said, condescending, rude, and just...
insulting.
Insulting to his assistant.
Only assistant, and apparently the only other person who lives in Toyland?
The only employee of Toyland. Because, so we got Tommy Kirk as Grumio, and he had invented a toy automation machine that will increase production of toys so they can send them out quicker. Good guy.
And here is our first mention of Christmas, where he says, oh no, I need to meet that Christmas deadline.
So he invents a machine that will make toys faster. He starts it off slow. He makes a doll. He makes a boat. But the toy maker says, well, we're just going to put this at full blast and make a bunch of toys now so we can get done faster. And machine go boom. Because he overloaded it.
Yeah. And this is if you suffer from sensory issues of any sort, this is a nightmare of a scene. There's like 17,000 sounds playing at different levels in this... really complicated, and there's flashing lights, and the colors are garish, and there is seriously, if you have any sort of sensory issues, just like leave the room for this scene. It is
you feel
awful.
For the machine, because the machine is literally yelling, help, 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 help.
Yeah, there's a little robot face on the machine that's screaming for help, and nobody helps the poor thing. You monster.
Because the machine is broken, because the toy maker broke the machine, so now Grumio can't turn it off.
Take an axe to it or something. Put this poor thing out of its misery.
And then the whole thing explodes. And the toy maker blamed Grumio for it, even though it was the toy maker that overloaded the machine. I hate the toy maker.
Yeah, the toy maker is awful.
In the original play, the toy maker was a villain.
Oh, wow. That's fascinating.
Yes. In fact, the toy maker is murdered, and Tom is blamed for it.
That sounds awesome. Well, not awesome, but it sounds less painful than this film.
It's a better story.
But you can't have murder in a Disney movie, except for all those times when you do.
Yeah, so anyway, and poor Grumio. He didn't know. He tries trying to help, and then... And that was the big thing about the toy maker. You know, you're the assistant. I'm the head toy maker. I'm in charge, not you.
You may have built the thing, but I'm the one who'll break it. Yeah.
And then it's your fault for making the machine in the first place.
Yeah. But having seen all this, our heroes finally stop, like, peeping to Tom outside the window. And, yeah. And... I'm not even proud of that. It's just everything about this movie makes me a worse person. But they finally come into the workshop and is like, oh yeah, we were supposed to turn ourselves into you because the trees caught us trespassing or whatever. But we see now that your workshop is broken. Maybe we could help. Why don't you put us to work as child labor?
So we can make that Christmas deadline.
The second time we hear about Christmas.
Yeah. So,
and he goes for it because the toy maker is a villain.
Yeah.
He's like, of course I will put children into a sweatshop and make toys for
them. And we get a big song about making toys and Christmas is coming. And the toy maker goes, yes, we should be happy when we work.
Yeah, and the children are very, like, boringly singing about how happy it is to work on a production line. They're like, I will paint a smile on the doll because painting smiles on dolls are fun. And you will put a boat on the conveyor belt. Ha ha ha. We are having joy.
Did I ever tell you that Walt Disney was notoriously anti-union?
Yeah. There's a shocker. The This is the least fun whistle while you work kind of song. Like, this is trying to be what would later become, like, you know, this is trying to be Whistle While You Work Again. Mm-hmm. Except it's not. It's Whistle While You Work if you have a gun to your head.
Yeah.
We're whistling while we work. Please don't shoot us. We really enjoy working for you, Mr. Disney. Like, it's like, it feels like watching somebody's, like, you know, kidnap proof of life video.
So apparently they've built enough toys in this time frame that, oh, we're going to make the Christmas deadline after all.
Yeah, they're back on track now.
Yeah.
You know, all of them working together have kind of made up for all the toys that got destroyed in the explosion of the machine.
Maybe toy makers should hire more employees than just the one.
Yeah, also, the toy maker wants the kids to keep working, and Mary is like, no, it is nighttime, it is time for dinner and bed. And the toy maker's like, oh, yeah, okay, I guess, whatever, have food and sleep.
I do love that apparently the time is very accurate in Toyland, as you can tell by the on the dot when night falls, literally, night falls.
Yeah, that is kind of a funny thing, is that Barnaby is like, hold on a second, night is falling, and then the green screen in the back changes from day to night in like a second, and he's like, there.
It's almost like that's a fourth wall joke, almost.
Yeah, it's not quite a fourth wall joke, because he says it to the henchman instead of the thing. There is one, we kind of missed the other thing that made me giggle, because there's a running gag in here of where Barnaby keeps saying,
let us pussyfoot.
Yeah, let us do various things, and the most common one is, let us pussyfoot, but at one point he goes, let us lurk, and they like climb into some bushes or whatever. They're like watching, but I just love the let us lurk. That was a cute running gag. Yeah,
it's like he's following a villain playbook or something.
Yeah, and now is the time on Sprockets when we scheme. Then we get my second most hated song in the entire film.
Just a toy.
Remember how she's not good at math because she's a girl? Well, now she sings a song about how there's a doll and all it is for is being pretty because there is nothing inside of its brain. But isn't it lucky that someone will give it love and a reason to live?
And then Tom sings, oh, you can be my doll. And then he poses her like a doll and she's okay with that.
Yes. Because if you are a girl and you can't math and all you can do is look pretty, what else is there but the love of a vapid boy?
Yeah. If you wondered why this movie wasn't a hit.
I really hate this movie.
Yeah.
Meanwhile. Anyway, moving on from the grand misogyny of that scene.
Meanwhile, Grumio has invented a new invention, a shrink gun. Because we can now, instead of making toys, we'll just make everything in the workshop a toy size, and we can do that.
Yeah. Fortunately, somebody eventually points out the flaw in this plan, which is that it like takes more effort to make a full size thing than a miniature thing. So why would you make a full size thing and then make it miniature instead of just making the miniature thing in the first place?
Yeah.
I
need a shrink gun.
Yeah, the thing is that one squirt of the shrink gun will shrink a thing, two squirts will shrink it so far that all of its molecules will scatter apart, and then it's dead.
Don't go into the quantum realm.
Yeah. The toy maker yells at him, yells at the assistant, and is like, this is a stupid invention, and throws it out the window, where it lands at the feet of Barnaby, because he was outside the window watching. So now the villain has a gun.
But it's a shrink gun, so it's with the Disney film.
Yeah. And he immediately shrinks the toy maker and puts him in a birdcage. And then he's mad at his henchmen, so he shrinks his henchmen and also puts them in the birdcage.
Let's talk about this, because this is the most ineffective face turn I've ever seen in a movie.
Yeah, okay, because the reason he shrinks the henchmen is because the henchmen are like... Okay, does he shrink Tommy first? I think he shrinks Tommy first.
He shrinks the Toymaker first, and then the Toymaker says, don't let him do that to Tom.
Oh, yeah, but he says that he's going to shrink Tom, and then he's going to hit him a second time and just kill him. And the henchmen are like, whoa, 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 we are not down with the murder.
Even though they were down with the murder earlier in the movie.
That was literally the thing they were hired to do at the first scene of the film. Like, go murder this dude. Like, not go, like, take him somewhere and get him lost where nobody will ever find him, or put him on a ship with pirates and let him sail away or something. No, literally go throw him into the ocean and drown him until he is dead. That was what they were told to do. And they were like, righto, boss, as long as the pay's good. And now they're not down with the murder?
Yeah.
You're right. This is the worst face turn in ever in history. It's like, nothing about this scene makes any sense. But they're just finally like, no, no amount of money can make us partake in murder. Okay.
And then Barnaby says, all right, and he shrinks them too. Stuff them also in the birdcage. Again, so their face turn was just ineffective.
Yeah.
Bad reason, and just bad
execution. Yeah.
Execution, yeah. So, yeah, and now he's going to do it at Tom. He does it at Tom anyway. We don't see it on camera because Barnaby just barges into Mary's room.
And he's like, you will marry me. And she's like, no, I won't. And he's like, what about this? And he holds up like a little gift wrapped Tommy.
Like, yeah.
A little mini wrapped Tommy. And she's like, okay, whatever, I'll marry you. Just don't
hurt Tom.
So, and fortunately, the Toymaker is also the mayor of Toyland, which means he has marriage powers, so they bring him out of the little birdcage, and they set him in front of a giant book, and they're like, marry us.
And kudos to the Toymaker for trying to stall as long as possible.
Yeah, he stalls, and Tom goes, wait, he's stalling. Maybe this is my chance for escape. So he, like...
Well, Fernando and Rodrigo untie him from the literal gift wrap that he's in. It's just ribbon from a Christmas present.
Yeah, and then they lower him off the table using the ribbon, and he goes into the workshop, and he gets probably, if you've never seen this movie, this is probably the only scene you've ever seen.
The toys are alive, and they are going to fight Barnaby.
Yeah, he gets a bunch of toy soldiers and a bunch of cannons and all these other, like, weapons of war that we give
children. The only song in this movie untouched, March of the Toys.
Because it has no lyrics. It's just an orchestration.
I want to talk about the stop motion in this scene.
Yeah, this was 6 months worth of stop motion work.
Yeah.
This was extremely labor-intensive. And it's very, you know, go back and watch some of the Ray Harryhausen movies from, like, you know, the 40s and early 50s, like really early stuff. Go back and watch even like King Kong and stuff, which was earlier than that, that uses stop motion. Those are better than this.
Yeah, but the effort's there. I think this is where all the money for the movie came in, because it's now people-sized toys.
Well, no. I mean, it's very obvious that these are, like, miniatures. Yeah.
But I'm talking about the interaction. Like, when Tom is turning the key on one of the toys, it's life-size. When during the sword fight later in the movie, those are the actual same toys, but now life-size.
Yeah, I think the building of the kind of shrunken down world probably took up most, because they do the same thing in Honey, I Shrunk the Kids later, you know, or they build giant blades of grass and all that kind of stuff. But that is very good. Technically, most of this whole final sequence with the shrink ray is really good, and almost all of it holds up. The stop motion is a bit wonky. Like, there are frames that are dropped, and they're, you know, some things skip around on screen where they shouldn't be. And so it's not really that smooth. But you can kind of forgive it because it's clockwork toy soldiers.
Yeah.
So they don't have smooth movement to begin with.
They don't have all that articulation and, you know, 38 points of articulation plus ankle pivot and ball joints.
Yeah. But are you speaking from a toy you just got? Because that sounds very specific. But this is, let's see. I really love stop motion. I love studying the technique. And just like in the dance sequences where you can see parts where the dance kind of goes awry, but they didn't refilm it, kind of the same thing here.
Yeah.
They kind of should have reshot a couple of frames here and there and edited them in, but they didn't. And so there's kind of just moments where it kind of weirdly bounces around the screen and it's not very
smooth. No explanation of how the toys come to life. They just do.
Yeah, it just Tommy shows up and like cuts open the boxes with a toy sword that he has and says like, hey, come on, we gotta fight, and they're awake.
And apparently they are actually playing March of the Toys because Barnaby here said, oh, they're playing, that's not the wedding march, they're playing the wrong song.
Well, yeah, a lot of the toy soldiers have instruments. So there's like the bugle corps and the drum corps and a few other things. We get our only non-white representation in this scene.
Native American toys.
Yeah, two red skin, like in the worst kind of things of that, you know, the bright red painted toys in
Peter
a bear.
Peter Pan wasn't that long ago.
Militaristic caricature, you know. Yeah, it's just, it very much looks like the Peter Pan kind of things.
I'm surprised they didn't sneak in one of the other Disney characters as a toy. Like, you could have had a Mickey Mouse toy or a Donald Duck toy in here somewhere.
Yeah, for a company that was so big on branding even then, I don't know why they didn't do it. But these are very generic toys.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, they all go to fight. They burst into the wedding. There's a rather, I won't call it good, but it's a rather technically well-done sequence of the toys fighting Barnaby.
And these are toy weapons. Yes, it's odd that some of them are exploding and some of them are just balls and sticky arrows.
Remember, they used to give our parents, like, you know, rags soaked in gasoline and be like, here, kids, go play. Like, there were
action figures with live firearms.
Yeah, there were no standards for toys at this time. I can fully believe they would just give you, like, now with real gunpowder, like.
So, and it kind of works, but then Barnaby realizes, well, he's a giant and they're all toys, so he kind of just squishes them and crushes them and grabs one of the toy cannons and fires it right back at them.
Yeah, he just started. You can feel okay with it because they haven't personified the toys at all.
Yeah.
They really just have kind of like clockwork motion. They're getting kicked around and broken and stomped, and if they'd have bothered to personify these, you'd be like, no, not the toy. Oh no.
All it is all that work of the previous day gone to waste.
Yeah, it kind of is. You're like, oh, well, now they're even further behind on their Christmas deadline. You know, it's kind of that is really the only consideration. You don't really feel for the broken toys.
Barnaby decides to stop playing around, grabs the shrink gun, and is about to send Tom to the quantum realm. But Mary grabs the cannon toy and destroys the shrink gun, which shrinks down Barnaby. The only useful thing Mary does in this whole movie.
Thank you. I was about to say that. I was like, Mary finally remembered that she has agency like 5 minutes before the end of the movie. This is seriously the only thing she does all film other than like sing to children. What a useless.
Ugh. Annette deserved better.
I know. Annette Funicello is amazing and I love her, but why? Why did you make her such a useless? She's just a toy.
But we do get a cool sword fight scene between Tom and Barnaby.
Yeah, now that Barnaby is shrunken down thanks to the accident that Mary causes, he pulls out the most awesome sword from the cane he's been using all.
It's a crooked sword because he's the crooked man.
Yeah, it's a sword with a crooked blade, and it is really awesome looking, and they have a pretty good sword fight. I mean, it's not, you know, Princess Bride, but, you know, it's a reasonably decent sword fight. They run around.
It's a better sword fight than the first Star Wars movie.
Yeah, it kind of is. But, you know, they've got some good choreography and some good jumping around and, you know, some interesting little action sequence here. And it's all done in a kind of oversized set. Yeah. You know, they have like giant letter blocks and things that are used as weapons. And
some of the toys you saw earlier are now giant size because, you know, need these actors to be on set.
Yeah, and it's really, it's once again, a technically good scene. Like, if you just watch this scene by itself, it's not that bad. But, of course, Tommy wins. He kind of stabs, but, of course, he doesn't, like, the knife doesn't go into Barnaby. It just kind of, like, shoves him backwards
into this jack-in-the-box, and we never see Barnaby again.
Yeah, as far as we know, he starved to death in the jack-in-the-box.
The fall could have easily killed him.
Well, yeah, that is true. It would have been a really big fall.
So we finally get Grumio back with the growing gun.
Yeah, he invented a way to regrow things that have been shrunk by his shrink ray.
Mostly because he shrank the toy maker's bed earlier and he kind of needs somewhere to sleep.
Well, technically the toy maker shrunk the toy maker's bed.
True.
So maybe let him, you know, it was his bed, make him lie in it. But he comes back in and he's got a gun that fixes everything, and they bring back the toy maker and Tom and the henchman. And we never see Barnaby again, so who knows what happened.
So now the henchmen are unemployed. They could always.
Yeah, but they're good guys now or whatever. I don't know.
I mean, there would have been a nice thing there if the toy maker had offered them a job. Hey, if I had all of these workers, we could probably make the deadline.
Yeah, like, you know, I've still got this Christmas deadline to meet. How would you like a job? That would have been a really good, yeah. But we never hear about Christmas or the deadline or anything again.
Also, the toy maker really never gets a comeuppance for being mean to Grumio. It's just Grumio decides to just, well, you're the boss, I'm the employee, I'm just going to do whatever you say. Good, now you understand.
And that's the end of that story. Did I ever tell you
Walt Disney was notoriously against unions?
Yeah. That's the end of that story. We never get a resolution for anything that happens in Toyland. I guess children went without toys that Christmas, and there is a very unhappy assistant hoping that his boss slips on a marble and dies.
So we fast forward. We don't know how long, but now there's snow on the ground. Since this movie took place in mid-October, I assume this is November, December?
Yeah, it's a couple of weeks later, maybe.
Yeah. They are now officially married. They leave the church. Everyone's singing how Tom and Mary are going to be happy forever. They get on a little sleigh with horses. And we get the Grease ending.
Yeah, I was really freaked out by the Grease ending. Like, the sleigh just takes off and flies them away.
Tom is Santa Claus.
I guess.
And Mary is Mrs. Claus, and they're going to deliver the toys with their two horses. It's not eight reindeer, it's two horses.
To be honest, that's the most Christmas that we get in this movie, I guess. Is that
they are wearing red and white. They are wearing red and white.
Yeah. I don't know.
And that's the movie.
This movie makes no sense. It is awful from top to bottom.
This was Disney's first attempt at a live-action movie musical, and it shows.
I checked out at so many points watching this film. This This may have technically been a rewatch for me. I don't know. If I ever saw this film as a kid, I immediately forgot about it. Like, it's as much as it was played on TV when I was a kid, I probably saw it at some point in that it was on and I was in the same room, but I have no memory of ever seeing this film. And now I know why, because I can't imagine ever watching this film again.
I watch this movie at least once a year for Christmas, and I do have my this movie is not perfect. I have more complaints year after year for this movie, but it's nostalgia for me. I will admit that this movie is just nostalgia for me. But is this a good movie? No. Like, most people will watch, like, The Room or MST3K to get their bad movie fix. This is, to me, it's Babes in Toyland.
You know, this film would probably be a fun riff. I don't know if, like, Riff Tracks has put out a riff for it or whatever, but it would probably be a fun riff with the right people, but that's okay. If we're asking the big question, does this have the Disney magic? I'm gonna say no, with a caveat.
Okay.
If you've never seen this movie before, it does not have any magic to it at all, really. There are a couple of scenes, like I said, if you took them in a bubble and just went, watch this clip, you would think this is a better movie than it is. There are some scenes that, while not exceptional, are enjoyable. They at least reach the level of enjoyable. But I can understand somebody like you who grew up with it and has fond memories from childhood that you're like, oh yeah, it still has that little bit of nostalgia magic. Okay, I can get that. Or if you want to see a piece of Disney history, because this was kind of a historical film for Disney. It's their first live-action musical. It's got a lot of their big stars at the time. You know, the people who worked on it are all Disney legends. Okay. It's a piece of history, but it is not an enjoyable film without nostalgia goggles. Yeah, no.
This movie does not hold up at all.
I can see why it tanked at the box office. Yeah. And I do think my father was right. I think that even though Walt is kind of known for being the guy who saw the next thing coming before it got here, this is the exact opposite. This is like 10 years before this would have been the zeitgeist. But in 1961, this was the okay boomer of films. Like,
the ultimate play it safe movie.
Not even that. It was just like, hey, you know what the kids like today with their 23 skidoos and their hoop and stick? Like, it's that kind of out of touch.
Hello, fellow kids.
Yes, it is. It is Grandpa Simpson's level. Like, Grandpa Simpson level of out of touch.
And I wore an onion on my belt, which was the style at the time.
Yeah, I mean, speaking of onions, this one kind of smells like one to me. It just is not. It's not a fun. I checked out so many times watching this film.
So yeah, I guess the official thing is, unless you have nostalgia for it, no. And I'll say it as a movie by itself, no. But my only love for it is coming from nostalgia.
And also as a holiday film, how is this a holiday film? They mention the word Christmas twice.
This is in Disney's Christmas movie list.
And everything lists this as a Christmas movie. Disney's Christmas romp. Disney's, you know, whatever. But it's not. And like I said, it's a movie called Babes in Toyland. And they don't get to Toyland until like 25 minutes before the end of the film. It's over an hour of not Toyland.
That's kind of the way the original was too. But at least they spent more time in Toyland. And you Toyland is an actual place and not just a factory.
You know what? If somebody ever makes the gritty reboot of Babes in Toyland, I'll give it another try. But I never want to see any version of Babes in Toyland ever again. No.
So you can watch the one with Drew Barrymore and Keanu Reeves.
No. I don't.
it says a lot that of the three versions of Babes in Toyland, this is kind of the best one production-wise.
I was talking to a friend about it, and he had only seen the Laurel and Hardy version, and he said of that film, it is the most awful film I have ever seen, and then occasionally Laurel and Hardy are funny. So apparently every version of this film is kind of garbage. Maybe don't ever watch it.
Yeah.
Unless you have nostalgia for it, and then I get it. I'm not gonna harsh anybody's yum in the nostalgia goggles sense. But if you've never seen it before, you're not gonna like it. I promise you.
Yeah, I think that's all we can say about Babes in Toyland.
I'm never gonna forgive you for this one.
Let's move on to next week. As a recent addition to the Disney home, a Disney family. Since The Purse is a Fox, next week we're going to be doing Home Alone with Macaulay Culkin.
And I'll just tease it now. There's going to be a very interesting Kiki Had a Weird Childhood in next week's episode. So if you enjoy our Kiki Had a Weird Childhood segments, boy, do we have a massive doozy coming next week.
So tune in next week for Home Alone. And that's all we got to say about that. And we will talk to you all next time. Bye.
Bye. Don't let the magic stop here.
Join our conversation online on Facebook at Rewatching the Magic.
Twitter at Rewatch the Magic.
And of course, new episodes every week at rewatchingthemagic.podbean.com.
Special thanks to our friend Ian Bonds for being our holiday announcer. Check out his videos on YouTube at Insane Ian or on Bandcamp at insaneian.bandcamp.com. Remember, the magic is for everyone.
It only stops if you let it.